I think from my background, just spending that time as a young runner and just being a student of the sport, and I just developed a love for it and a passion for it, and it's been my whole life really. I remember my mother actually talking about it to my wife not so long ago, that she never dreamed, you know, that when I was 15 years old starting, you know, join the Harrier Club, that I'd end up where I've ended up.
Kia ora tātou. Koe rā Craig Kirkwood. Ko Matt Raymond tēnei.
Ko Eugene Bingham tēnei.
Ko Dirt Church Radio mātou. Ngā kōrero ngā hau, me ngā kaiuma ngā hau. Dirt Church Radio is proudly sponsored by Ultraspire, and they are telling us via Telegram, because they come from the South Island and they can go to the shops and stuff, no problems, to send telegrams, that the Zygos 4, the official pack...
Is it back?
The official pack of Dirt Church Radio, the official pack of the Kepler Challenge 2020, the official, it got to New Zealand, the supply lines are open, they are back in stock.
Wow.
These
We're
packs,
big fans.
We are big fans. We both own a Zygos 4. We recommend them to everyone. Sean Collins owns one. Tom Hunt owns one. Grant Guys probably owns several.
It's so good to wear.
Yeah, so good to wear. Carry all your gear for a big day out or a loop round the block.
Just round, yeah, round the block.
Park run.
You want to wear one?
Yep.
Yeah, just do it.
Bladder, bottles, carry your poles, carry, like Kepler, we wore it last year for Kepler. We've had other iterations of the Zygos. You cannot go
We had our compulsory snorkel just tucked away in there.
Absolutely.
Didn't even notice it.
Didn't even notice it. My fins, yep. Amazing.
It was beautiful.
There's a deep cut back to the fact that it was wet at Kepler last year. But yeah, look, ultraspire.co.nz if you want the Zygos 4, get in while you can, because these things will go like hotcakes.
They will. Hey, also, Wild Things, you can use the code DCR2020 and join up as a Wild Things VIP member. Get 15 months for the price of 12. Gets you access to a whole bunch of stuff. You know their trail directory?
Yes.
The Gnarl Factor.
Is it Gnarl Factor or Gnarl Factor?
It's Gnarl Factor.
Right, the Gnarl Factor.
It could be Gnarl Factor. Is a measure of how technically demanding a Gnarly run is. And the higher the number, the gnarlier...
Gnarlier the run.
Gnarlier the run. Simple. Yep. So it's an amazing thing that you get access to the trial directory. If you're a VIP Wild Things member, you can use that. Use the code DCR2020. Get 15 months for the price of 12. And they chip in a bit to help out little old Dirt Church Radio. Win. Do it.
Gnarly.
It goes something like further, faster, there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to further, faster now.
Oh, further, faster, there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to further, faster now.
Church Radio.
So, episode 111.
We made it.
We did.
Do you know about the cricketing superstition about 111?
Have you? How much time have you spent with me over the last 2 years? So,
but you are so well read
about that everything. I thought you
might.
Sport.
Yes, I thought you might have picked this one up.
I don't
no.
like cricket.
Okay. When people get when teams get to 111, everyone in the stand, the batting side, has to hold their feet off the ground.
Why?
I don't know. It's just a superstition.
Okay.
Until they get to 112 or whatever. So I think we should try and do this episode like with our feet off the ground.
Okay.
We'll levitate. We'll levitate. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
There you go.
All right.
I'm just here to spread the knowledge.
Another reason for me to dislike cricket. But look, sorry, not sorry. How's it going, Will?
Yeah.
We're stepping down levels.
We're going down the levels. We're going the right direction.
Yeah, indeed.
Mm.
But I feel like in terms of levels, I feel like we leveled up with our conversation today.
Yeah.
With Craig Kirkwood.
Mm.
So, I mean, we've had some of his tenacious champion athletes on Dirt Church Radio, and his pedigree as a coach is phenomenal.
Yeah.
In fact, he reminded me of, like, when he talked about his sort of his grounding, like he young age, just threw himself into it, studied, went to school, studied it, and then basically went and sat in with these dudes in London. He reminded me, like, not explicitly, but like someone like Miles Davis or John Coltrane, just going in and just living the life and
learning and learning,
you know,
and learning
the craft.
Yeah, just soaking stuff up, and then, you know, you see the results from his athletes.
Absolutely.
So, and himself.
And the man himself.
And himself, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, so that conversation with Craig Kirkwood coming up. And, you know, last week, speaking of his athletes, you know, that conversation with Mel Aiken.
Yeah.
You know, third time she's been on Dirt Church
Radio.
Absolutely. And, you know, what a wonderful conversation. Heaps, heaps and heaps of feedback about that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah. But yeah, that's coming up. First of all, how have you been, man?
I'm still on the hamster wheel.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's just, you know, I'm sure lots of other people are on the same hamster wheel. It's just this is the new normal, hey? And it's just kind of one day you're like, oh, the next day you're like, yay! And but I had a really great couple of runs on the weekend.
Yep.
Ran with you on Sunday morning. That was amazing. And then ran again on yesterday, it was amazing. So, you know, I'm not complaining.
The double run. How did Rigby go with that?
No, Rigby was fine.
Yep.
Like, it certainly rubbed the polish off him in the end. But he woke up fitter this morning. So,
going, we're a double run team now. Come on.
We do. We run twice a day. Look, if I had my druthers, I'd run twice every day.
Yeah.
100%. I think it's one of the best. It's one of the most bestest things. I think it's good for you. It's good on your body. Good training, it feels good, and you feel very privileged to do it. So yeah, I can't complain. What about you, man?
Yeah, cracking along, trying to come up with a plan and remain positive about Kepler. Looking forward to that. Can't wait to get down. Can't run the marathon this weekend.
No,
in Rotorua,
you can't, because you're from Dorkland.
That's right. But you know, we figured that we had the accommodation booked, so we're going to go down, back your backyard, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We'll try not to breathe my Aucklandness on anyone.
You're going to go and spectate, or they're going to?
I don't think
we're allowed. Can
you?
You're like, we're from Auckland.
Yeah, we've just stand socially distanced from everyone.
Yeah,
I'll try and clap. Hello.
Yeah, do the golf clap.
Yeah, yeah. There's a few people going down that were coming up and going down. Not me. No, nobody going down. Sorry, except from Northland, I suppose. But coming up country from it and stuff. It'd be good to see them. So I might find a spot on the road to cheer and things like that. Yeah.
K34. Is a really good one. So when I lived in Rotorua, my friends, our good friends, they lived exactly at the 34-kilometre mark, which is just past the airport.
Yes.
And we'd go out and we would spectate and clap and hand out jelly beans. And
I can't hand out jelly beans, can I?
Well, you could just put them on the road.
Throw them. No, I can't do that.
I'm from Auckland. Just as someone's got a handful of jelly
beans
in their mouth.
Yeah, as if put them in their mouth.
But yeah, K34 is a really good, because that's where you're coming into town. You've come over, you've come through Haumarana, come past the airport, and you're in that final.
Mm.
It's just amazing. Mm. People watching at its finest.
Mm. It's good fun.
And what's this?
I'm going to take my trail shoes down, and I thought I might head out on the trails, and I may even see if I can spot that robot.
What robot?
My hallucinations.
Oh, right. Okay, that's a callback to your Tarawera.
100K, 100 miles, sorry. Yeah, when I'm sure it was there.
I saw that in the show outline, and I was like, what are you talking about? Some sort of Scion, you know, Scion plant, the forestry company that got robots.
Forest Research Institute.
Yeah.
We're going to come up with robots.
They probably have.
They probably have, yeah. In fact, didn't Paul used to work there as well?
He did. He worked there for years and years and years. So did, interestingly, so did Garth Weinberg, the world single speed champ. So something about working at Scion and being in that forest.
Wow. Was he a robotics guy?
He's a robot, but he's a robotic guy. But Garth Weinberg is a robot.
Right.
Patrons.
Yes.
So if you'd like to support what we do, we'd love you to come on board by setting up a regular donation, even for the cost of a cup of coffee a month, or just a cup of coffee once off. It would help us do things that are a bit outside our reach at the moment, buying audio equipment to improve our sound quality, or getting to more races to interview people when we're allowed to leave the house. It would also help us keep the lights on with domain costs and stuff like that. Yeah, so we're on patreon.com/dirtchurchradio, and if that's not in your wheelhouse at the moment because things are tough, that is karawe.
Totally cool.
Totally cool.
Right. Stuff you should know. Cool.
Kia kaha te reo Māori. So it is, we're still in the reo month, which is fantastic, and it is Mental Health Awareness Week this week, which is really important for us to consider. I at times I've thought the Mental Health Awareness Week was perhaps a bit twee. I'll own that, but I think at the moment it's really, really important. And the Mental Health Foundation of Aotearoa have come up with a really good theme this year, and it's Reimagine Wellbeing Together, which is Hei Tirohanga Anamata. And it encourages us to reflect on the big and small actions and that we've taken to take care of each other this year, and to look at wellbeing through a new lens, because I think it's something that we can all reflect on as runners and people, that, you know, we're in a new normal. I think that this Mental Health Awareness Week's really important as well, because what it's done is it's to take Te Whare Tapa Whā, which is a Māori model of health developed by Sir Mason Drury, and we use it a lot in mental health, and to look at they've actually added one, but the four domains of healthcare. So it's really Te Whare Tapa Rima. Yeah. So, but that's fine. But what it does is it talks about the four walls of a whare. And Te Whare Tapa Whā basically split into four parts, which is taha wairua, which is spiritual health, taha tinana, which is our physical health, taha hiningaro, which is our emotional and mental health, taha whānau, which is our family and connections. And they've also talked about taha whenua, which is the land. So the days of they've busted them down into themes, and when you're hearing this, we'll be on Wednesday, 23rd of September, which is whenua, which is return to nature, something that as trail runners,
hey, yeah,
get into getting out into the bush and looking at, you know, how we engage with the land. Thursday, September 24th is taha tinana, which is our body, so thinking about, and you know, speaking to Craig Kirkwood, engaging with our body, how do we replenish ourselves, how do we refuel ourselves, sleep, all those things. And then on Friday 25th, that it's hiningaro, which is our mind. So things that we do to think about keeping ourselves well. Super important, and especially in this time. So if you go to the Mental Health Foundation of New Zealand to check that out, Reimagining Wellbeing Together, Hei Tirohanga Anamata.
Awesome.
Yeah. So important.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
So important. And
I like how they coincided Wednesday with the release of Dirt Church Radio.
Yeah.
No, returning to nature. That was good. You can pull some big strings, man.
Fully.
Yeah, far out. Gosh. Far out. No, that's, yeah, really important messages and simple things to do.
Yeah. And I think, again, so, you know, and talking about also wairua, the spirit.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, and I think in sort of a, tying it in there in a more kind of European standpoint, you know, you've got your mind and your body and your family, but you've also got your spirit, your wairua, and how this time can affect us. And maybe it sounds a little bit airy-fairy, but it's really not. We need to keep ourselves well, and we need to keep ourselves kind of firing on all cylinders. So there you go.
Wow, there you go. So we, you know, there was the Three Peaks Challenge. The final event was in Wellington on Sunday. And we sort of, I was going to say reached out. I don't like using the word reached out.
We communicated with Chan Dima from Run Wellington.
Yeah.
And Chan's a glorious human being.
Glorious human being. And he sent us in a bit of a report. So for those of you who don't know, the Wellington Three Peaks is an iconic event, really, isn't it? So it's over winter, open to anyone who wants to experience the trails, covering nine peaks in Wellington. Wellington is not short of hills or wind.
No. And you can guarantee that, like, if so, nine peaks, three individual events.
Yep. And it's organised by the Wellington Scottish Athletic Club.
No.
Yeah.
That's no joke at all.
No joke at all. No joke at all. So usually the series is run over April, May, June. It's a sort of low-key fundraiser for the club. And the idea is to designate three Wellington peaks, which are, you know, you navigate each of them via road, trails, and head back to the Wellington Scottish Club rooms. And the event's got a long history in that it was part of the club's 100-year regular winter calendar, where people could do a Sunday long run through winter. But, of course, it's this thing called the pandemic. They were going to cancel the event altogether. But as Jandima says, as they came out of level four lockdown, they discussed the options with the club committee, and Andy, co-organiser, and I, as Jandima said, we decided to still run the event series but raise funds for Wellington City Mission.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that's just amazing, amazing. And so they ran the events through July, August and September instead, with the last one finishing on Sunday. They had a fantastic response and they were able to keep it within the government guidelines because they didn't collect cash on the day. Participants could donate online, so we didn't have to collect cash. And over the three events, they had 140 people who ran or walked and raised over $1,000 for the Wellington City Mission.
That's fantastic.
Fantastic.
Humans are clever and adaptable and have as much of a shocking propensity for being stupid. They have almost an inverse ability to be just amazing. And, you know, that thought of, you know, us as having privilege that we have a disposable income and the ability to go and run and
And lots we can share that.
Yeah, we can share that.
In a very tangible way. So they also got support from Gareth Thomas, from the W2K race director and the Y Run Fest. And so he's setting up this new event called the Y Run Fest. And so he came on board and gave them a free entry to his event, which went to a participant who did all three events. And that was they gave it to Andrew Rutherdale. So he got an event for either the 43 or 63K at the Y Run Fest, courtesy of Gareth.
Poor bastard.
Good luck, Andrew. Yeah.
And that's said with a lot of love and respect.
It is. You know
that's going to be tough.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Four Paws Marathon, that was on. That looked like a lot of fun. I've seen lots of cool social media out of that.
And I must admit, I kind of went, because they said that the dogs couldn't do the 42K one.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, I know, I guess I'm kind of, I it makes sense, unless you own a Kelpie.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
If the dog had finished, it'd be like my dismembered arm holding, like a Tarantino movie. And just trot across the line.
Yeah, but that looked like a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It was good to see events. Yeah. The Athletics Wellington Road Champs were on in Wainui Mata over the weekend. I just wanted to mention that Ruby Muir.
Yeah.
2017 National Cross Country Champion won the women's title in 35:17, a 13-second PB.
It's incredible. I've heard the 2017 National Road Championship 7 silver medal performance.
Yep.
Nicole Mitchell was second in 37:33 and Esther George in 37:53 PB. Fantastic.
Yes. So Hamish Carson was the winner of the men's, 29:56. It's not bad.
That's bonkers. What's your 10K PB?
Not the 29:56. so that was he bettered his personal best as well, 32:23. Wow, that's a huge improvement.
That's a massive one.
Yeah, and Eric Speakman was second, 30:17, and Daniel Jones was third. And Daniel Jones,
yeah,
there you go. He was third in 30:56. Other PB. Wow, what a great event. Anyway, remember how Adam Keane reported into us from last week? He's our correspondent, South Island correspondent.
Stane Savage.
Yeah, Stane Savage, yeah, from that FKT on the Otago Rail Trail. Well, he pointed out to us another epic run on the rail trail, Andy Smith. He did a double rail trail over 4 days. So that's 4 days in a row of 80 kilometres, 200 miles, epic. Well done, Andy.
I'd love to ride the Otago Rail Trail, but I'd also love to run the Otago Rail Trail. Does
four times?
Probably not 4 times in 4 days.
Two times. But yeah. Wow. And the other thing that we talked about last week.
So it's the big backyard alternative with the satellites events, teams from the USA, Canada, Ireland, Australia, Germany, Russia, UAE, Ukraine, Hong Kong, Japan, Switzerland, Finland, France, Singapore, Philippines, Israel, Spain, Denmark, Mexico, Norway, Sweden, and Aotearoa. Standalone backyard ultra winner and an assist. Now I'm sure that I'm keen to see the Canadian team, and I'm really proud of our team. But have you all seen the team from the USA?
American team.
Coming again to save the day. Maggie Gutierrez.
Yeah.
Harvey Lewis, Gavin Woody, Amelia Boone, Courtney DeWalter, Joe Fayez, Mike Wardian. Chris Powell, Jack Conrad, Jordan McCallie. I don't even know who some of these people are. Philip McCarthy, David Johnson from Hallertau. I'm presuming it's not that David Johnson. It might be. Gabe Rainwater, Sarah Moore, and Aaron Ellison.
Some of those names in there are.
Yeah, you're just looking at all the like comments defending world champ Harvey Lewis, best part of 58 yards.
606 miles in 6 days.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow.
It's, yeah. Goodness me.
Yep, it's going to be fun. So that's
on Ding Dong, that's for sure.
In New Zealand, it starts on Sunday, October the 18th at 1 a.m.
So that's, yeah, the day after our election.
Yes, well, an hour after the day after our election. There you go. Blue Lake Challenge, 24-hour challenge is on this weekend.
I feel really pleased that that can go ahead.
Yep, and Rotorua Marathon on this weekend. Have fun, everyone.
Absolutely.
Greatest run ever,
which is the part of the show where we ask you to write into us and tell us your aforementioned greatest run ever. It doesn't have to be a race or a mountain summit. It might just be a run around the block, something that's sung to you for some reason. Send it into us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. And this is from Lee Sturmer, who's
a great friend of the show.
Yep, formerly of the dearly departed Aussie Grit and a real stalwart.
Fair dinkum bloke. Ran the last little bit of Tarawera 100 Mile with me. Anyway.
Amazing. So this G'day, is... Lee. G'day, gents. My first ultra marathon, the inaugural Guzzler 50K Ultra in Brisbane in July 2019, was a rollercoaster ride and one hell of a steep learning curve. Being very new to running with 6 months of training under the belt, I went into the race without a time goal, just aiming to finish. However, I certainly wasn't prepared for what was to come. A very tough and mountainous course and the very hot Brisbane winter's day saw over 20% of the entrants not finish. The first 20 kilometres flew by and things were feeling great. However, with the adrenaline of race day and a lack of experience, looking back, I now know I'd gone out too hard. Approaching one of the more rugged sections, climbing up Mount Nebo, I pulled out the hiking poles and began the ascent and found one was broken and unable to properly extend, even though it was fine the night before. An inconvenience, sure, knowing that there was about 1,500 metres of elevation again to go, but that was nothing compared to what I was to experience next. All through training, I'd used liquid calories and gels and never had any gut issues. Sounds like Morgan Freeman needs to come in here and go, but he certainly had gut issues. Well, I was in
he
for
was
a,
to find out.
Yeah, a rude surprise. Damn. I'd had four gels and half a sandwich by this stage and slowly experienced an onset of stomach cramp that quickly proceeded to feeling like a physical brick in my insides, slamming every internal organ. If you could imagine trying to walk in an upright fetal position, that would be a good way of visualizing it. I stopped at the next aid station around the 25-kilometre mark to refill water and hiked on in some punishing pain through until 37 kilometres. Frustrating, as this 12-kilometre section had some very runnable bits. But when I tried to pick up the pace, within 50 metres, the pain in my gut would intensify and affect my breathing. The stomach was rock-hard like cement, and I definitely don't have abs. I thought to myself, as long as I could keep moving forward, there was no chance of quitting. I'd coke for the first time at 37 kilometres, at the aid station, quickly discovered that it's the nectar of the gods, and and the gut was feeling a little better, and I was able to get some slow, intermittent jogging going for the next 7K. I didn't realise at the time, however, that with the stomach issues, I hadn't eaten anything since the 30-kilometre mark, and beginning the final savage Kokoda climb, I was feeling incredibly faint and dizzy, and at one point, a convenient tree I just passed halted a tumble backwards down the hill. There wasn't far to go, and the finish line was not far away now, and with the vision blurring and basically crawling up the hill, I eventually got to the finish line, that final hill section taking over 45 minutes to complete 2 kilometres. Yikes. I was elated to cross the line after that experience, and afterwards I was told that it was the perfect learning experience, that with almost everything that could go wrong going wrong in regards to pacing and nutrition, it will hold me in good stead for next time. So I have some unfinished business with this race, and with it coming up on what will no doubt be a hot November day, I'll be out for redemption. Kind regards, Lee.
You are one tough.
That's tough.
Bloke, yep, Lee.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And able to kind of reflect on that as a learning experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shows your quality.
Yeah.
And we hope you're doing okay as well.
Yeah.
We need to mention, we've had a man down.
We have.
We should have mentioned it at the top.
Mm.
We had a man down. Harry.
Shout out to Harry.
Hope you're feeling okay, bro.
Yeah. Speaking of tough.
Yeah.
Whew. Right, now the rest of you, get some greatest runs sent to us, will yous?
Yeah, don't be cowards.
Yep, go on.
On to our show. Craig Kirkwood. I felt a little bit kind of nervous.
Yeah.
I did.
Absolutely.
So Craig's been in endurance sports since he was 14 years old. So he's been in it for 14 years. He's had many times competed on the world stage at the highest level. He wouldn't tell us how old he was. As a runner, he's been to 2 world mountain running champs, the world cross country championships, the world half marathon championships, world student games in the 10,000 metres, and the 2002 Commonwealth Games for the marathon. As a triathlete, he's been to the world Ironman championships 3 times, 2009, 13, and 15, the world 70 70.3 champs in 2016, where he finished sixth, has been selected four times to compete in the ITU World Long Distance Championships, finishing ninth in 2018, and once in the ITU Duathlon World Championships. Craig is a coach. He is based in Tauranga, and this was an excellent conversation. So without further delay, Craig Kirkwood.
Digits Radio.
Okay, all the way from Tauranga, we have Craig Kirkwood on the line. Craig, kia ora, how are you?
Kia ora, I'm very well, thank you.
Hey, thanks for coming on. It feels like we sort of, not know you already, but we've talked to so many super fast people who you coach. It is really nice to have you on Dirt Church Radio.
Now we have the master.
Yeah, we have the master.
Well, I don't go too far, but appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure. I listen pretty regularly, so well aware of what my athletes say about me. So I've got to tune in. they're not letting out any secrets or anything.
Have you had to go back to any of them and go, oi?
Mal Aiken, we have a good giggle about some stuff on there occasionally. I don't tell her off though; she's a bit too scary for that.
Yeah.
It seems to be the common theme, eh?
Yeah,
with Mel, she's just a little bit frightening.
And yet, in person, she's so sweet and lovely.
She's lovely. Yeah, she's so lovely.
Hey, so why don't we go right back to the beginning? Because we wanted to do a bit of a deep dive with you, if we don't mind, just to sort of get our heads around how you came to your philosophy of training and coaching and run through some of the amazing events that you've competed in. But how did you get your start in endurance sport?
Well, goes a long way back. It turns out I'm pretty crap at team sport. So I learned this when I was quite young, and I was reasonably handy at running. So this was probably about 13 or 14. And I started doing some cross country running and was doing okay at it. And gave away soccer because I was not a very good team sport player. Just progressed from there. Did pretty well through school. I never really had a coach through school, so I used to pick up Arthur Lydiard's books, and he's probably the foundation for what I kind of do now, as most probably athletes of my era were kind of Lydiard disciples, if you like. So I just picked up his books and would read through the programs and kind of learn as much as I could from them and do the things that were in there, because that's what Arthur suggested. So I was like, if it's good enough for Peter Snell and those guys, then it's good enough for me.
Wow.
So cracked into that and, did pretty well through school and made a lot of mistakes and kind of,
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Timaru, all places. Yeah,
and were you surrounded by the runners, or were you just the kid who'd be sitting there with the Lydiard book and then out sprinting everyone in the cross country?
Yeah, pretty much. There were a few guys who used to run against, but none of them really kicked on. They were just kind of good at school level and never really kind of had the passion. And I think they didn't become students of the sport. I think it goes a long way when you see a young athlete who kind of starts learning about the history and learning about the competitive follow globally, and then they develop a real love and a passion for what they're doing, at a high performance level, I guess. And they go from there. And that kind of happened to me, I guess. I was, entrenched in the sport and knew who everyone was and learned as much as I could about training and racing and all the different events. So,
yeah. I'm not sure how old you are, but and it's a different old place, I know, but were you the Eddie Crowe era?
He was a couple of years older than me, so
right.
I think the year that he and Richard Potts had a big showdown at Auckland Nationals, I was still a junior, I think. So I'd have been like new money, year 10.
I feel like I'm talking to two very similar classically trained absolute dyed in the wool.
Yeah, but one of them's really good and then there's me.
This is the thing with Eugene and you, Craig, it's that thing, it's hard to understate. I mean, I came to running in my 30s, it's hard to understate the depth of the influence that Arthur Lydiard has had on so many people as an outsider.
It's also sort of instructive of a different era, because I we heard of, I went to school in Auckland, and we heard of Eddie Crowe, and sort of you'd see the results in NZ Runner and that sort of stuff, and there'd be legend of him, and he played for the first 15 at Oamaru and all this sorts of stuff, and then actually getting to see him for the first time at those Auckland champs was quite something. And it's a different era, you know. You don't see, you didn't see people running on Facebook, you didn't see videos of them doing their training and all that sort of stuff. It was quite, you know, different times. I'm aging myself.
Yeah, because you did just see the names pop up in results, but you had no idea what they look like or who they were, or
that's right,
knew anything about them. It's a very different story. I mean, I've recently been coaching Sam Tanner, who's lighting up the junior world in New Zealand, and you know, he's well connected with all his you know, guys he races around the country, and they're, you know, all friends on Instagram, and send Snapchats to each other, and so it's a very different world in terms of the way they communicate and the way they bond, and yeah, so they show up at, you know, at a race and everyone's mates already, and there's no hiding anything.
I mean, you have something in common with Sam Tanner, is that you went to the States as well.
Yes.
And did your collegiate program, is that what they call it? Sorry if I'm butchering that.
Yeah, essentially. So I went back in the era where you had no idea where you were going and what you were walking into, the environment. It was just impossible to do proper research around the environment you were going into. So I went to the University of Oklahoma, and it was a really good school, and it was an awesome experience. And I wouldn't turn it, you know, go back and change anything, but except for maybe the university. It was really, really interesting, because the guy who recruited me was a pretty good coach, but I've rightly or wrongly, I've kind of referred to him often as a bit of a used car salesman in terms of coaching, that he could recruit really well, and he had quite a lot of good athletes, but he wasn't essentially a great coach. And we basically did our own thing for the majority of time that I was there, which probably was really good for me now that I've had so many experiences and, you know, tried so many different things in training and failed, you know, terribly over the years, that I kind of understand what works and what doesn't, and what's going to be really bad idea and what's going to be a great idea. So so probably foundations for what I've learned over the years, is, you know, it's paying dividends now, but it probably would have helped me to have a better coach at the time.
I mean, it must have been growing up in Timaru, and, you know, everyone's Timaru, you know, the Deja Vu song, Today, Tomorrow, Timaru, and all that, and small town South Island. But moving to Oklahoma I'm guessing it was in the 90s?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Oklahoma in the 90s must have been quite a culture shock.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. Because I remember arriving there, and there was, you know, I'd left here in December, because I'd finished school in December and left like 3 weeks later to start university. And it was, you know, middle of summer in Timaru, and as such as it is. And then arrived in Oklahoma, and there was snow on the ground, and it was freezing cold. And I'm just thinking, oh my Lord, what have I done here? this is not a great place. But, you know, there was a really good group of people there, and who were on our team, and there were quite a few other Kiwis who were there as well, so that made it more tolerable. And, you know, we got together quite often and had our Kiwi experiences, which was pretty cool.
Did you have – was it the time of Timothy McVeigh?
Yes, it was. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think he was my biology teacher at the time. His brother was killed in the bombing. Getting the call in class.
Oh my goodness!
Right after it happened, it was an awful time.
Yeah,
in Oklahoma.
And isn't it like tornado area through there?
Yes. It's the
Did you experience any of those?
No, thankfully. It was the University of Oklahoma, I think, is the US's number one meteorological school. All the tornado chasers congregate there in tornado season, and they go out and chase them from the university. But they, up until only a few years ago, a big tornado had never hit the town of Norman, which is where the university is. So they'd hit all around it and demoed lots of little towns, but never the university town. So, it's pretty crazy, the storms there. They get some unbelievable storms. It was quite frightening at times.
Yeah. Camille Heron's family lost their house in that, didn't they?
Mm.
They're in that area, aren't they?
It's madness.
Yes, they are. Yeah, I used to run with Camille's husband. So
Connor, right?
Yes, yeah. So I met Camille when she was probably 14 or 15, still at high school, and she was kind of hanging around with the university athletic team and kind of hang out with us. And then she eventually, her and Connor got together.
Yep.
A few years later, I must admit. But yeah, so that goes way back. So when she comes out to New Zealand to run, she stays at our house and we catch up with them. It's really awesome. She's such a lovely person.
Do you deliver beer to her on the run?
No. That's Connor's job.
And I guess
my wife is at my house, so.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been, again, thinking about, you know, Sam Tanner, who I want to touch on later, and you and your experience, yep. Just the thing of, yeah, going to the, everyone's on Snapchat, you can talk to your mum, you can FaceTime, you can do whatever, just that kind of, that loneliness. I mean, what is the, and I know that we've talked to other people like Ruth Croft who've been over and done the collegiate program. What is the life of a collegiate athlete? I mean, what did you study, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, when I originally went over, I wanted to do architecture, but all the lectures were at the same time as I was required to be at the track for training. So I had to give that away quite early on, and I did a sports science degree.
Ah.
So, yeah, so it was just, yeah, it's like any student really, except we had requirements to be at training every day. So mostly we ran in the morning before lectures, spent the day at lectures, and then went to training at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And yeah, that was it. Went to study at night, and yeah, normal student life, plenty of drinking and partying and stuff. But yeah.
So you're training, what, 14, 15 hours a week?
I think that was the plan. Didn't always work out that way. But yeah, it was generally double runs every day.
Yeah. Right. So, and was it, did you do track and cross country?
Yes.
You know, like year round sort of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah. Indoor track was my least favorite. And I know Sam Tanner loves it, but it was never for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a strange thing, isn't it? We don't really have that culture here, do we?
No.
We don't have the weather for it.
No. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, I guess it'd be hard to do a run. It'd be hard to do a track meet in Oklahoma in January, wouldn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It was, quite often there was ice on the ground, and, you know, you couldn't run outside because it was just way too icy. You end up falling over.
Yeah. So what was your, you had that grounding in Lydiard philosophy, and then you were there where you were being basically, I imagine, being sort of told how to run and told what your regime is. How did that sit with you?
Well, pretty well, because the guy who was there as a coach was English, so his philosophies weren't too different.
Okay.
He was just a little bit hands off, and yeah, the Irish guy, well, Connor, he was there, so he and I used to run mostly together every day. So a lot of times we would just do our own sessions and do our own thing for the most part. So yeah, so we just kind of experimented, and I tried to keep up with him, and he was always faster than me, and so he ended up smashing me around, and I was his hack, essentially. But it was good fun. We had a great time. Yeah. But in terms of philosophically, it was fine. You know, the English methodology was very similar, and the thought process was very similar.
Yeah.
There's always that it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know if it's a Commonwealth thing or it is. Or, and I know when we speak to people on this show who are English or from the Commonwealth, it's always, there's just that little bit less lost in translation sometimes from our North American
that's right, yeah.
Brethren and sistren. You know? Yeah. So you finish at the University of Oklahoma, and then what, do you come back home or do you stay in the States?
Yeah, well, I spent they paid for 5 years for my degree. So I was in no hurry to go and work. So I took 5 years to finish.
Wow.
Just enjoy my time as being a student. And then I decided I was going to stay in the US for another year. And I got a work permit for a year to stay on. I worked part-time in a gym and did a few other odd jobs and just did some road racing, made a bit of money. And kept my head above water, and I kind of enjoyed being in Oklahoma at the time, and so I stayed there. And then at the end of that year, I was talking to my father about coming back to New Zealand, and he said, oh, you know, have you thought about going to the UK? And at that point, I'd never considered it. It wasn't even, you know, nowhere on the radar. And then he planted the seed, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll go to the UK. So I decided that I was going to go. I only knew one person who was living in London at the time, because I'd gone to the US straight out of school. I'd been 6 years away from New Zealand and kind of lost contact with all my friends. And so, you know, the ones who had done OE and were in London, I had no idea. I just lost contact completely. There was no internet or, you know, no way to communicate with those people really. So, so I just went to London and dosed with a friend and found a low-paying, horrible job for a few weeks. And then I ended up scoring a really good job. I was actually trying to get a job with the London Marathon. One of the coaches I'd met over there was the elite field organizer for the London Marathon. I was trying to get a job through them, and they didn't have anything going, but he put me on to a friend of his who was an agent who represented a lot of the top Kenyan and American middle and long distance runners. So he got me a job down there with them in southwest London, and I spent 2 years, more like 3 years, working for that organization, and you know, working side by side. And now I look back, and I was essentially assistant coach to Olympic champions and world record holders, and you know, some of the fastest guys on the planet. So it was, you know, a super help to my development as a coach and as an athlete, and you know, just an amazing experience to be part of. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that must have just really, I mean, I was thinking the word fast tracking, which is a bit of a pun, but yeah, fast tracking your sort of knowledge and I guess opening your eyes a bit too of what's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was, you know, these guys, you know, come from Kenya, and they really have nothing other than, you know, just a huge engine inside them and poverty at home. So they're super driven to get great results, and, you know, they fight hard and they train hard. And, you know, what the coach told me there, or Kim, who I work for, was one of the things is, you know, that kind of athlete, there's no secret to the training. They just need to do lots of, you know, lots of big work, and really in its simplest form is just, you know, just give the engine some work to do and they'll run well. And it sounds really simple, but it's really not that complicated. When it comes
to it. Yeah. It's an aerobic sport, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I guess there's also the thing about, you know, like you said, it's not like, you know, a privileged bunch of Charlies like we are comparatively. That's existential, right? Like a second place at, I don't know, or a top five finish at a large marathon. That's a lot of Kenyan shilling.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What did you see in terms of, because one of the other things that comes through whenever you read or see anything about the training of the Kenyans and the East Africans is rest. And the other thing I noticed is sort of drills. What, did you notice, you know, was anything you observed in that regard?
Yeah, so I worked really closely with them. So they all lived, well, there was a couple of houses that they all lived in Teddington, which was the area of London. And they all just lived together, and there was kind of four or five in a room. And I'd go around to the house quite a lot to do different errands and what have you. And they'd be just kind of lying around doing nothing. And that was essentially all they did. So they'd get up in the morning and they'd run. They'd lie around. We'd take them to the track for a workout at kind of 10 o'clock-ish. They'd come back and they'd cook some food and they'd lie around, you know, and then go for another run in the afternoon. And so that was kind of their existence while they were, you know, in training base, and that went on for months like that. You know, and when it's their day to run easy, they go out and they just run really, really easy. They don't care, you know, people get tied up these days about, you know, the average pace on Strava and all that kind of nonsense. And, you know, it's not how training is done. You know, when easy running is supposed to be easy and let the body recover. And they're the masters of that for sure.
There's two things that strike me and your Strava comment with the Kenyan. Did you see that that meme that went up when Strava crashed? Or no, Garmin
crashed yeah.
and someone there's the photo of Eliud Kipchoge saying, me and my mates just do it for the Strava, and if it doesn't sink, we go to the pub. But also that thing about, you know, and I fall into this trap too, if it says, you know, if I run 9.8
8 kilometers or whatever.
Yeah.
Have to run 10 kilometers. And that's just so at odds with, you know, that kind of mentality, which is just like, I've got an easy run today, so if I get back to the car and it's that, then that's an easy run.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to make so much more sense, and I don't know why I chase that.
Yeah, you're not going to be, there's that saying, isn't it, you don't see the Kenyans running around a car park to, I've just got to get it up to 10. I've got another. Yeah.
I deliberately leave mine on 9.99 if I can. Just OTD, it winds me all up.
Yeah. What about the sort of other stuff, the drills and the stretching and that sort of stuff? Is that a thing?
It is a thing. It's not a massive thing. It's more a movement skill.
Right.
And so when you're running that fast, you have to be able to move really well. So, and if you look at those guys when they're running, you know, a kilometer at, you know, 2:30 pace or something like that, and look at the range of motion through their hips, and have to be able to move really, really well to be able to get into that position and run that fast for that long and remain that strong. So so the skill is, the drills aren't just, you know, I'll go do drills and I'll be as fast as them. It's a function of their movement.
Right.
So which everyone could work on, because if your range of motion is better and your strength through those really weak areas in your range of motion is better, then you will run faster. There's no question. But they do that. Yeah. So we used to take them to the track a couple of times a week for sessions, and you know, they'd go through their warm up, which included, you know, all sorts of drills and what have you, before we get into the main session.
Uh-huh. In your expert opinion as a coach, is there one area that runners that you see, and I know it wouldn't be universal, but is what's the main area of kind of imbalance or main area that people could improve on in terms of strength or range of movement?
Generally, it's through the hips. So either hip flexor tightness, or they lacking, and I hate the phrase, glute strength. But more, because most people have strong glutes, they're just not functioning very well, and they're not firing in the right order and with their hamstrings. So if they can work on those two things, they'll probably improve their form drastically. Yeah. And then also think about their running cadence, which has an effect on their stride length.
Is that complicated? And sorry, we are going to take this deep in terms of moving then into triathlon, because if you spend time on the bike and then running, surely that has different effects on the hip flexors.
Yeah, it does. Yep. So, so cycling is, you know, notorious for tight hip flexors. Mm. And you see a lot of long course triathletes who, run in the bucket, with a, they're very stooped, and, you know, they're kind of shuffling along. And that's because they lack their hip flexors, flexibility, too much time on the bike. So it is important to work on that from a triathlon point of view.
I feel seen. Matt's kind of staring at me. My hip flexors and my running in the bucket. But it's definitely an issue, isn't it? And you mentioned the glute, not so much strength, but just the firing. And it's, you know, recently had to have some physio, and it was amazing just getting that activation, which is another word that I don't really like, but it's true, isn't it? You can have that muscle there just not working, and you got to tell the brain, and it's quite an amazing thing to actually have that. Like, I know what I need to do, but it's just not doing it. And then it sort of eventually clicks.
It's a very complicated thing to do. If you do the exercise where you're lying on your floor, on your stomach, and then, you know, trying to lift your leg even just slightly off the ground, activating your glute first. It's very, very tricky. You've got to really concentrate if you don't get a firing pattern. Yeah.
I wonder when we lost that.
Too much sitting.
Yeah.
I
find that.
Sitting at the desk, sitting in the car.
It's incredible how much, because I'm a nurse, how after, say, a hard session or a hard, you know, training and then spending a day on the floor, I generally feel okay. But, like, I came to work today and now I'm a bit more up the food chain, shall we say. That sounds terrible. Or I'm more sedentary at work. I sat down today doing you know, cursed reports. And then I got up and I felt like I was about 400 years old.
Yeah,
like
you feel it was so, don't you?
It's such a terrible, yeah, such a terrible thing.
Mm.
Yes.
So you had success yourself. You know, obviously you had that, you were steeped in that background, you know, from when you were growing up and then going to college, but you also had that experience rubbing off on you alongside those champions. Must have been great, and it led to success for you. You know, a couple of world mountain running championships, a couple of cross country champs, world half marathon champs, and the Commonwealth Games. What's it like to pull on a silver fern?
It's pretty cool. Like the first time I wore the New Zealand kit was at the World Student Games in 1997, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty special. It was in Italy and on the island of Sicily, and that was pretty cool to kind of get the uniform out of the packet and put it on.
Yeah.
I remember that. It was one of my you know, most memorable moments. Every time you pull on that black singlet, it was pretty cool. And, you know, get to represent New Zealand. Didn't always work out the way you want it to, but that's elite sport. And, there's only, you know, maybe two or three people who show up to a race like that and have a race they wanted, and the rest kind of walk away disappointed, which is, you know, the harsh reality of sport.
Yeah. Have you got a favourite event or a favourite, sorry, meet that you raced in for New Zealand?
Well, that's a good question. Probably the world half marathon champs I went to in Zurich. I don't know what year that was, 1999 maybe. And we had a really good team that year. And we all met up and we just had a really good time with the team. There was quite a good bond, and we had a good race. I raced quite well, that was probably running around Lake Zurich. It was pretty awesome. It was a pretty cool trip.
So I guess it's more it was the whole experience. So, you know, I guess if you don't have that bond with your team, you don't have that great experience off the path, as it were. It's not going to make the run that much more exceptional.
Yeah, I would love to have said it was my Commonwealth Games experience, but for me that was, you know, super disappointing for the most part, because I was injured in the lead up. I was probably in the form of my life. I'd spent 10 or 12 weeks training in Kenya. I'd arrived back into London probably, you know, thinking I was in probably 2.9 to 2.10 shape, ready to have the race of my life at the Commonwealth, and got injured in London in the you know, a few weeks before. The whole experience was just soured from that. And it wasn't a really very happy time.
I can't imagine that feeling of when you are so well prepared and then so close to it, it just doesn't go right for you for injuries.
And it was, you know, it was horrible, because I arrived in London and I'd hurt myself, and about a week later I had to go and prove to the New Zealand Olympic Committee that I was still fit. So they required us to do a 10K road race, and I can't remember what the standard was, but we had to run something like 29:20 for 10,000 metres on the road to prove we were fit. So Jonathan Wyatt and I, he was in the north of England, I was in London, so we'd met in Birmingham to do this road race, and we ran together, and we both ran 29:08 or 29:10 or something. And every step of that run, as fit as I was, it was easy, but it hurt every step. I was so badly hurt.
And that's not the preparation you need going into a marathon.
No, absolutely not. And I didn't want to run it because I knew that it wasn't going to help me prepare. I had to do it to keep the Olympic Committee happy. That's, you know, one of the failings of high performance sport is that you can't dodge that stuff, and if, you know, that's a requirement for you entering the games, and you kind of have to do it regardless of you know, maybe the smart move now, and if I had really good advice at the time, they would have said, look, let's just pull out and live to fight another 4 years time, you know.
I was going to ask that. I mean, did it have a long tail of repercussions?
Yes. Yeah, very long. So it probably ended my elite career. I didn't finish the marathon at the Commonwealth. So I came back to New Zealand and went through probably 18 months of treatment and diagnosis and trying to get it sorted, and having spurts of being able to run, having spurts where I couldn't stand, I was in so much pain.
What was the injury, yeah. Do you mind saying?
So it was, they call it osteitis pubis, so it's inflammation of the pubic bone. So, and I'd ruptured the disc in there as well, so it was just a complete shambles. And they ended up doing a mesh insertion under the abdominal wall for like a hernial operation, so which actually healed it in the end, but it took 2 years to get that surgery, get a diagnosis and get something in hand to get it done. And then it probably took another year and a half to 2 years to come right after that. So that was, by the time that time passed, my ability to run, you know, at that level was gone. I attempted to qualify in 2008 for the Beijing Olympics. And I may be fast forwarding in this conversation a bit, but that's when I decided that if I didn't qualify for Beijing, then I was going to do Ironman the following year. So I said to my brother-in-law that he was signed up. So I said, if I don't qualify for Beijing, I'm doing Ironman with you next year. So that was the start of my triathlon career.
Wow! Oh, so that's how that came about. So we were going to ask that. How did that happen? So there you go.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. So I'd in that year before I'd done a swim with my brother-in-law in Auckland, one of those Takapuna somewhere swims, and it was my first ever non-running event. Well, my first ever event that wasn't running, so I hadn't done anything else. And we did a 2K swim, and I remember coming out of the water and running up the beach, and my wife was there, and I said, "Oh, where's Darren?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know, assume he's still swimming." And I was like, "Oh crap, I've beaten him." Completely and utterly shocked. I'd never swum, you know, more than half a length, you know, pool, you know. So,
So you just took it upon yourself to just do a 2K ocean swim without training.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and I'd borrowed my mother-in-law's wetsuit. Swum more than probably 50 meters at a time.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, it's analogous to other things that you see, you know, and I think about the upbringing that you had in terms of the craft and the mindset more than anything. It's not so much the mechanism of movement, is it? Unless it's something super, super technical. Yeah, you probably, yeah.
It's the competitiveness.
Jump in the water and go.
Yeah, everything kicks in, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's just that aerobic engine you build, isn't it? And if you've got the swimming technique, as horrible as it might be, you can just, you know, just keep the engine revving and you're fine, as long as you don't redline yourself and... that's kind of what got me through, I guess.
And, I mean, you know, that went pretty well for you as well, Ironman and triathlon.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a reasonable few years of doing Ironman and, enjoyed the sport. I still jump in the odd half Ironman. I don't know if I'll ever do another proper Ironman, maybe. But
how was Kona?
Hot. Hot and windy. No, my first experience there was unbelievable. It was super cool there. Such an awesome race and such an awesome experience, and didn't get it right the first time and went back a second time to try and get it right, and that didn't happen, and went back a third time to try again, and that didn't happen, and now I've got no desire to try and amend that. I've just chalk it up to great experiences and having been beaten by Kona.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a long list of people, isn't it? It's just incredibly tough. But
I think one of the hardest things for New Zealanders is that we leave winter and go to 40 plus degree humid temperatures, and, you know, it's so difficult to acclimatise yourself for that position when you can't get in that environment
and that it's coming at you from all directions too, isn't it? It's not just the sun, it's the road, and it's just coming from everywhere, isn't it? The hot wind.
I remember stepping off the plane the first time and you know, taking a deep breath and just going, oh my god, it's like an oven. I've just opened that door and it's going to be like this for the whole time I'm here.
And
staggeringly hot.
Were you coaching full time at this point, or?
No, not the first time I went. The last time I went over there I was. It was interesting. I assume we're going to get to this question, but I'd done Ironman and I arrived back into New Zealand. I think it was 2013, and no sooner had I arrived in the door and my boss rang me and was like, "Oh, we need to have a meeting," and ended up being made redundant from my job. And I'd started coaching a few people just on the side, just helping them out, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and do this full time. I love coaching people, and I love kind of helping them with their journey. And so when that occurred, I threw myself into coaching and haven't looked back.
What was your job previously? Nothing to do with coaching?
No, it was a terrible sales job. I got paid reasonably well, and that's what kept me there. The security of the paycheck, and but the environment was pretty horrible, and I didn't enjoy it, didn't fulfill me, and wasn't something I wanted to do forever, but it was just the money was too good.
Right.
The money's nowhere near as good now, but I love what I'm doing. So
And that makes all the difference, doesn't it?
Oh absolutely.
Mm. But you know, you had the sports science background, you had that experience in the UK. I guess it must have just been sort of like written in the stars.
Yeah, and I think when people ask me when I started coaching, I guess the answer, truthfully, is probably when I was about 14. I started coaching myself, and then, made lots of errors and learnt lots through the years. My time in London was probably the icing on the cake in terms of high performance coaching. That was an eye-opening experience, being around, guys who win Olympic gold medals. It's pretty special.
Yeah. So when you started out that full-time coaching, well, I guess when you started to, coach people before you made the switch to full-time, did you have a sort of a grounding philosophy, or was it, did you put much thought into that at the time, and has it evolved over the years?
I don't know if I did or not. And I still don't know if I have one, to be honest. But my philosophy probably differs depending on who I'm dealing with. Mm-hmm. So if I'm dealing with someone like a Hayden Wild or a Sam Tanner, their outcomes are very different to someone who's just jumping into a half marathon and Rotorua this weekend or something like that.
Yeah.
They're doing the same sport, and they each have their own goals, but what they're trying to achieve and why they're trying to achieve it are very different. So I think my kind of philosophy needs to adapt to that so that I can be on the same level as them when we're, conversing about what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
I don't know. It sounds a bit airy-fairy.
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, and that's the thing, isn't it? Like, because you've also, it's not as if, you can't sit there with Sam and say, "I don't know what it's like for you to go overseas and, or I don't know what it's like for you to actually be able to reach for that brass ring and seize it." And as, like, for instance, myself, as hard as I trained, I would not be able to run as fast as Sam Tanner does for lots of different reasons. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm old enough to be his father, of course, but, like, that's the thing. Whatever. It is a different mentality. I mean, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? If you took on a coaching client who's like, "I want to run the Rotorua Marathon," you're like, "Okay, here's Sam Tanner's training plan." I mean, you'd be hurting people left, right, and centre.
They'd be broken inside a week. Yeah. Or probably more importantly, Hayden Wilds.
So is that? How sort of individual do you have to get?
Extremely individual. So I coach for a good example of this is someone like Mal Aiken.
We've heard of her.
Yeah. Versus, I don't know, someone else, some other marathon.
Mal Aiken.
Marathon. Yeah. Her capacity for work is unbelievable. Like, she's probably, aside from Hayden, she's probably got the biggest appetite for training out of anyone.
Right.
Maybe Carl Reed is probably there as well, but they just have this ability to. She just has the ability to just to absorb load, and loves to race. So normally I would, and I do try and stop her from racing week on week, but doesn't
you're
always.
You're not doing very well.
I've done better. I've done better in the last year than I.
You're responsible for coronavirus. I need to come up with something to stop male racing. I know, global pandemic.
Yeah. So we've had some conversations about this, but yeah. So, but her ability to race and then bounce back and not, you know, be sore or beat up for a few weeks physically and mentally is probably second to none, really.
Mm. Yeah. So in that sense, and I'm not trying to make it specific to Mel or breach any confidentiality or anything, but sure, sometimes is it a matter of, yeah, sorry, Mel, but sometimes is it a matter of like getting someone to pull back?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People love to do too much. Yeah. Ultra people are the worst for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They think more is better, constantly, which is sometimes a very hard thing to shift, that mentality.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and you're so right, and I think, I mean, I've fallen into that trap. I'm sure you have as well, yeah. Eugene. And I remember talking to some people who I would hold in quite high regard. I still do, but when I first came onto the scene and then talking to one of them and just saying basically at that time that, you know, they'd arrive on the start line of a race and they'd just be patched together with, you know, strapping tape, ibuprofen, which is a terrible idea, and badly injured. And it's not like you're running a 29-minute 10K, you know, then doing a 17-hour or whatever ultra. And it's not sustaining, is it?
No, and it's not healthy for people to be doing that to themselves. Mentally or yeah.
It's almost like taking that sort of, again, thinking about existentialism, you know, like you, not so much the philosophical standpoint, but, you know, and there's all these people profited off it, right? Like, and I'm not picking on Chris McDougall, but when the natural running came out, you know, and it's like a completely different cultural construct, you can, you know, the bushmen of the Kalahari can run for 40 miles and then get up the next day and do it again and again and again and again, but it's a totally different existence. And we're trying to paste that onto our like very sort of sedentary middle class lives.
8 to 5 work and that sort of
stuff. I have to run and catch my dinner.
I mean, and you've got to be careful when you read stuff in books too. Like, people only ever talk about their best times ever and their best experiences. They never write down those awful moments when they're completely broken and hurt and miserable outside, and they always talk about the great times. So
Maybe we need to switch our greatest run ever to worst run ever, just to get some reality going.
I'm not prepared for that question. You can't.
You've been schooling up, but and I guess, sorry, just on the volume, but also you mentioned earlier pace as well, isn't it? You know, people have got to learn to run easy.
Easy
runs are easy.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, the physiological responses you get from, you know, the variety of training you can do, you've got to tap all the systems to keep the engine, you know, running properly. So easy running is certainly very important for recovery.
Within your coaching and talking about sort of diving deep, I mean, you look at, there's such a wide variety of coaching styles and coaching, and I think about someone like, say, Jason Koop, who goes really, really granular. Is that something that you get into with your approach?
Only if I have an athlete who is really, really into that. And then quite often I find that if they're that in tune with the data that it's really important to them, they'll seek someone who coaches that way as well.
Right.
It's not the way I like to coach, but I can dig into the data if someone wants me to. But I don't enjoy that. It sounds horrible, but coaching by numbers, I'd much rather have a conversation about how they're feeling and, you know, what they got out of that session, or if it was a struggle or than looking at the data, or, you know, heart rate versus pace versus incline, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't tell the whole picture to me.
It must be such a skill to integrate those two.
Yeah, it's art versus science. You know, maybe I'm an artist rather than a scientist. I don't know.
But it's funny. I spent a little bit of time being coached by Barry McGee, and yes. I'd send him off my, you know, what I'd done for the week, and very sort of proudly setting out sort of stuff, and he'd write back these beautiful emails, hardly mentioning anything about what I'd the numbers, and I'd be almost wanting to go back to him going, but Barry, did you see what I did on Wednesday? You know, and that was the point. It didn't really, it was much about much more than the numbers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And he's from the era, from Arthur Liddy era. So he, yeah. You know, they wouldn't have had a GPS watch.
No.
They wouldn't have known where the K markers were on their runs. They wouldn't, yeah. It'd just be, they went out for a 2-hour run. That's all they did. And they ran hard.
And I think about, I mean, we've got a friend, Sean, who to this day, he's a very able, very, very capable runner. He's terrifying, actually, and he runs with a Casio, you know, yeah. And that's his, and in this day and age, and if we go out on a run with a group of people who haven't met Sean, it's almost like quite a talking point, you know.
Yeah.
His watch is $1,000 less expensive than your watch, and it does the same thing.
Yeah, well, I have an athlete like that who's a very accomplished marathoner, and no GPS on that watch whatsoever, which is, I find it quite difficult at times when I'm you know, asking for a certain pace to be run, yep, for a certain distance, and it's all done by feel, and you know, as now it kind of go, I go, oh, so annoying that I can't look at that data. And then I think back to when I was marathoning, and you know, we were the same, we didn't have any data, so it was all done by feel, and
you
hoped you got it right.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, and as a big, like, and this is the thing as well, like thinking about what you're talking about with growing up running, and I wonder if this is a thing that also, you know, might be a thing when you, if you come from a place where running wasn't fun, or it was torture, or you weren't very good at it, when you learn to run even comparatively fast, it's such a joy, do you know, it's such a joyous thing, and there's such a novelty to it. And I wonder if that's a thing for people as well. Like, I know for me, like, I can be guilty of just going everything too comparatively fast. And that's because it's so much fun. You know, like, there's almost that trying to recapture that, I don't know what it is, just going out into the woods and running around hither and yon like a child. And it's like, you know, Emerson said, you know, in the woods is perpetual youth. But do you think that has a point in it, you know, like you've got these kind of middle-aged warriors going out now and trying to sort of reclaim their youth with all the inherent dangers they're in?
Yeah quite possibly. I mean, I think from my background, just spending that time as a young runner and just being a student of the sport, and I just developed a love for it and a passion for it, and you know, it's been my whole life, really. You know, I remember my mother actually talking about it to my wife not so long ago, that she never dreamed, you know, that when I was 15 years old starting, you know, join the Harrier Club, that I'd end up where I've ended up. And so it's been this kind of lifelong journey. Whereas I think people who get into it later in life and pick it up as a, you know, in middle age, so we say, and they're moving into an era where there is all this technology, and you know, you can buy all the gadgets, and you can, and if you don't have that history or that background, you know, you only know what you know. You jump into it with that knowledge, which you can. It's easy for me to look back and go, oh, well, they don't know what they're doing, but that's all they know. So what else can they do?
Yeah. Have you still got those original Lydiard books that you had?
Yes, I do. Yeah, sitting on my shelf behind me right as I speak. Yeah. With probably all my notes written all through them from when I was 15 years old.
Yeah, little pencil marks and stuff. I've got that. So you talked about your mum saying what she thought of, you know, what you would be as that 15-year-old, but do you think 15-year-old you or 14-year-old you would look at you? What would 14-year-old you think of looking at you now?
Oh, God. that's a very profound question. I don't know. Thinking back probably to that time and growing up in Timaru, it wasn't a massive running group in town. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't anyone running at the kind of really high performance level. And I think running was very different in those times too. But I probably looking at someone like myself now who's coaching, who, you know, I think I do reasonably well what I'm doing. I'd probably be in awe, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it sounds really stupid to say that, but I think that's I think that's what I would think.
Yeah. Doesn't sound stupid at all.
No. Yeah. And having represented New Zealand and, you know, done all of that, I bet the 15-year-old you would be pretty impressed.
And I think I'd say that because when I was young at school, one of the kids at school, his dad or his uncle, I can't represent New Zealand at something, and I just remember at the time just thinking, oh wow, that's, you know, that is unbelievable that, you know, that person could represent New Zealand, that's incredible. And now I kind of it doesn't give me that same feeling, but that's maybe because I've been there, but I remember at the time being, you know, completely awestruck by that notion.
And I mean, what I thought was really refreshing is how you reflected on the fact is when you went to the World Half Marathon Champs, you know, how good that was versus the fact that you went to the Commonwealth Games and, you know, it is the, well, it's not the, it's one of the pinnacles of the sport, especially, you know, as a Commonwealth athlete and the shape that you're in, you're actually able to honestly go, yeah, it was an epic bummer.
Yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. as good as it was, and it doesn't sound churlish or ungrateful, but it's a really honest kind of standpoint too.
Yeah, yeah, and I think what made it really hard is that when I qualified for the Commonwealth that year, I'd beaten a guy, Andrew Leatherby, who's an Australian, by almost 2 minutes. We both qualified on the same day. He got the bronze medal that day. And I remember Jonathan, I'd already pulled out, and Jonathan Wyatt, came across the line. I think he was sixth from memory. You know, he was pretty happy with his run, came across the line. He kind of had a chat, and then he said, oh, who won, who was second, who was third? And when I told him that Andrew Leatherby had got third, you know, he broke down. That was, you know, quite hard for him because he was in that same point where he, you know, if he'd had his day, he could have got himself a medal as well. So, so it was those experiences where, you know, they just doesn't work out for you.
Lots of stars have got to align, don't they?
Yeah, someone else has a great day and it works for them.
Hey, thank you so much. This has been a really wonderful conversation and quite dug quite deep sometimes, I feel. So thank you for being so so open and honest with us. Really appreciate it. But I think, you know, you indicated you'd schooled up for this question
because
you
know it's coming.
Yeah, but Craig Kirkwood, what's your greatest run ever?
Yeah, I must admit I did think about this one. So I mentioned before that I was in Kenya doing some training, and I can't remember whether it was 2000 or 2001. I had two stints there, and I was in this training camp in the back blocks of Eldoret in a place called Kaptagat, and it was in the middle of the forest, and on this During the week, all the guys were there training, and then generally on a Saturday afternoon, they would leave the camp and go home to their families. And quite often, I was the only one in the camp on a Sunday. And generally, so I'd go out and do my long run into the forest. And this one Sunday, I didn't get lost, but I made my way to the top of the escarpment, which is the road that runs along the top of the Rift Valley. And so I climbed up through the forest and got to the top, and I was running along the edge of the Rift Valley and just kind of running through, you know, all these little farmlets and these baboons running around on the escarpment, and it's just this amazing scenery with the Rift Valley just below me, you know, 3,000-foot drop into the valley floor and up the other side like a big skateboard bowl, and just running along the road along the edge just going, this is unbelievable, I can't believe I'm here. So, you know, that stuck with me for, you know, since that time. And it was a pretty special moment to be in a place like that and be able to just kind of run with freedom and enjoy what I'm doing. Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool run.
Yeah.
I mean, how's that from the boy from Timaru?
Yeah.
You know, your 15-year-old self and then you're like training in Kenya, running along the Rift Valley.
Yeah.
The cradle of civilization.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. It was such a cool place to be. I mean, it's again, you know, it's like anything. I reflect back on great moments like that, but there were some pretty horrid times there too, where it was, you know, I got sick and it was, you know, pretty hard going, being so isolated in the bush. But that was a moment that I'll never forget.
I bet. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
I love that he's still got those books.
Yeah, I bet he does.
Yeah.
I bet he's still got those books.
Yeah.
With the little notations.
Yeah. Wow, what a conversation. Thank you, Craig.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And, thank you for...
Yeah, as we said, thank you for opening up.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Mm. As ever, putting up with my digressiveness, but...
Whatever.
There you go. Mm. It's like you're having a run, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And some of those, like, if you...
Oh, we love you.
I remember looking at his Instagram stories and watching Sam Tanner, like, in the gym, just crushing it with the strength and then just destroying fast running.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tearing a new
but
one.
Getting the easy runs done as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's important.
Yep.
That's actually a massive learning for me. Get the easy runs done easy.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, look, thank you very much for tuning in. We're on social media at Dirt Church Radio, and you can email us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms, and you can download direct from the website, which is dirtchurchradio@gmail.com.
Did you say the weird site?
The website.
The website. The website. The weird site. Don't go to the weird site. Just stick to the normal site.
That's dirtchurchradionights.com. Also, if we're not where you want us, let us know. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us. And if you like what you see, please spread the love. It would be great as many people heard the show as possible. And for that, we need your help.
Don't forget to write them with the greatest run ever. Don't send it to the website. Send it to us. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Thanks to our sponsors, Scott Running, Ultra Spire, Further Faster, Spring Energy, and Cieli. Remember, the Ultra Spire Zygos 4 is the best pack that you'll ever own, and they're back in stock. Thank you to our Patreon patrons, we really appreciate, and also to Wild Things.
Thank you to our editor, Kieran. We have got a great guest lined up for next week, so tune in then. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
Thanks, Rigby.
Gnarly.